Welcome to the first in a series of Safeguarding podcasts. My name is Julie Farley, and over the next few months, myself and other colleagues from the children's and adult safeguarding teams will be here in Oldham, inviting local people to share their stories and talk about what's important to them. The aim is to explore different ways to help keep each other safe. We will also be inviting local professionals to reflect on their experiences of safeguarding and interviewing experts and academics to help us think differently about how we work together to change things for the better. For our first interview, I am delighted to welcome Norma Howes. Norma is going to share her thoughts on what practice informed by trauma looks like. Norma has a wealth of experience and has contributed to our understanding of the impact of trauma at local, national, and international levels. So, welcome, Norma. Can you start by telling us a bit about your background and the work that you have been involved in?
Certainly. I qualified as a social worker and probation probation officer in the 70s in Glasgow. That's my hometown. I was managing a homeless families team and the domestic abuse refuges when I was 24. Bit crazy, but that was what things were like then. I moved or managed to manage a team in Maidenhead, and that changed my life by introducing me to sexual abuse. We never had any sexual abuse in Glasgow when I worked there. Of course, that's not true, but we weren't recognising it. My training then followed on working with victims, but at first not with perpetrators. But at a conference I was challenged by a chap from Texas on how it was possible to work with victims. He asked me two questions. How can you tell the difference between a victim and a perpetrator when there's a strong likelihood that they're both the same person? And two, how can you undo the brain fucking when you've never worked with the brain fuckers? Well, that was a challenge and a half. But another challenge followed on pretty quickly from a 13-year-old who wanted to make a complaint about her social worker. She said her social worker only focused on what was done to her and not what it did to her. Goodness me. I knew that, but I always said, I'll send you a counsellor, I'll get you a therapist. And she said, that's ridiculous. Social workers need to know not just what was done, but what it did. Well, that took me into training as a therapist and working in a child trauma team for 12 years. I undertook some further training on forensic child psychology and enjoyed that too. I'm now involved in training, consultation and supervision on all aspects of trauma, but really focusing on relational trauma, such as domestic abuse, sexual exploitation, and with young people involved in sexual and other criminal offences.
Thanks for that, Norma. So the term trauma is used in many different settings and different ways. How would you describe what it means?
It's very concerning that the word trauma is used when really people mean stress. So I'm going to be clear, about what trauma actually means. The simplest way to differentiate stress and trauma is using Dan Siegel's window of tolerance. If you can imagine a sheet of A4 paper with a dark line drawn a third of the way down and another dark line drawn two thirds of the way down, within those two lines is what's called the window of tolerance. That is the amount of stress, excitement, sadness somebody can manage but can also tolerate it. When that becomes intolerable, there's two choices in terms of your reaction. One is to become hyper, which would be above the top line, and the other is to become hypo, which is below the bottom line. So we have a hyper or a hypo response. Tolerable stress in the window enhances our abilities and the window widens. Not just individuals, but that also happens in organisation. Toxic stress or trauma keeps the window narrow and disables our abilities as individuals and as organisations. It's not unusual for coping strategies or responses used by clients to be mirrored in the organisation. I'll give you some examples of what happens in the window and what that looks like out of the window. In the window, anxious. Out of the window, anxiety. In the window, tolerable. Out of the window, intolerable. In the window, creative and dynamic. Out of the window, blaming and shaming. In the window, positive thinking and planning. Out of the window, catastrophizing. In the window, doing joined up thinking. Out of the window, disjointed thinking, or even the coping mechanism called dissociation. We are trauma informed. Out of the window, we are inspection and target led. In the window, we say, how can I help? Out of the window, we say, where can I signpost you to? How often do we actually ask ourselves, where am I in my window? And where is my organisation in its window? And how does this change when we're hearing about or experiencing stress or trauma? A little bit more information. Being out of the window in hyper or hypoarousal then needs the unconscious psychological coping strategy of dissociation to ensure we can survive the intolerable physical or emotional pain, which would otherwise be incapacitating. We do this by disconnecting our behaviour from our affect or emotional state, from our soma or how our body is, from our knowledge or meaning of what is happening. And we do this by using one of the seven Fs. Of course, everybody has heard of fight and flight, but we need to add on a few more Fs. We have fight and flight and feed and reproduce and freeze and flop and fart. And in the language, there are explanations for all of those Fs. We know fight and flight, but feed, we have a gut reaction. Some people get IBS. Some people feel sick. We have butterflies in our tummy. All of those things are in the language. Freeze. I was frozen with terror. I was in a frozen state. I couldn't move. Flop. I just gave up. And fart. Scare the shit out of somebody. I was shit scared. So of course, all those words are in the language because we know them, because we experience them.
So Norma, when we discussed this earlier, you said that the trauma response can become the default response. Can you explain this?
So, if flight or running away or disengaging or fight, which is becoming aggressive, proved the most useful to use, then that's what's used the next time we're in a similar situation. But it is actually really easy to mix these two solutions up. There is a fight to survive the intolerable, but the way to cope with the intolerable is to flight. If we think about that, whether drug misuse, alcohol misuse, self-harm or domestic abuse, if we put it into that context, then what do we hear? I will fight if my children returned, but what I am required to do is just too much. It's intolerable. So I flight to drugs or alcohol or food or a dangerous behaviour or a partner to make life and loss tolerable. Or I can flop into self-neglect, which is what I deserve to be, neglected. And that gets confirmed by others by not noticing, or worse, noticing but standing by and watching. One of the other things to think about is when we're looking at self-blame from a trauma model. To believe as a child that there's something wrong with you, blaming yourself for not being livable or for not trusting someone or for causing something to happen, absolves your parent of responsibility for their actions. It's a really useful way to give yourself hope that one day, if I can change, my parents will love me. But when you're told by or experiencing care and value from a worker or foster carer, and you're just beginning to believe that you might be lovable or acceptable or even likeable, this means accepting that a parent was incapable of loving you, but you know your parent can't change and was to blame, but that means giving up on hope of being loved by your parents. So, when someone says, it's my fault this happened, it is really not helpful to say, it's not yourself, it's not your fault. But instead to ask, where does that thought come from? Tell me about a time when it was your fault. Has anyone ever told you that? Was there ever a time when you wondered about it? The explanation, it's my fault, and the tenacity with which that belief is held on to is very, very difficult to change. It takes time and trust and a reliable relationship. In the same way, waiting for something to happen can be or is intolerably stressful. So when there is the feeling that there's no control over if something is going to happen, violence or abandonment, for example, the solution is to make something happen. And by doing that, you can take control of when. Problem with that is it gives a feeling of not just being responsible, but also of, importantly, being in control. So it becomes very important to hang on to that feeling and to keep that behaviour going. If we think about how that applies to domestic abuse and drug and alcohol misuse, neglect, withdrawal, not being in control is just as big a challenge as being out of control. So of course, the only way you can have control is to take control of when, because you've got no control over if something is going to happen.
Can you describe a situation where this is played out within a violent or an abusive relationship?
Sure. Yeah. I can remember one woman that I was doing an assessment on. She was living with a violent partner. And when we were chatting about it, she said it was her fault that he hit her. Instead of saying to her, it's not your fault, she was asked to give an example of a time when she would say it was her fault. No shaming, no blaming, just gentle curiosity. Empathically asked, tell me about a time when you would say it was your fault. The time she recalled was one time when she was watching EastEnders and the storyline was coming to a climax. She could tell when her partner returned home from work that by his attitude and tone that there was going to be violence later. So instead of waiting for this to happen, she pressed his buttons deliberately so that she could get it over with, so that she could then relax and watch her programme. Whose fault was it? Because this was then reinforced by him saying to her, if you had not antagonised me, I would not have hit you. And then making her apologise to him for doing this. She felt as if she was in control because she was controlling when. She was making his dinner at the time he demanded. She felt in control of her situation and of him. To continue to function at any level, everyone, not just this person, but everyone needs to feel as if you have some control over your situation. If you don't, you could flop into neglect or flop into what looks like depression. The other thing we need to think about when we're thinking about this sort of situation is, what impact does that have on the children watching those parental dynamics? Who do they see us to blame for what has happened? Well, if mum had not, then dad would not. Problem is that what I hear workers doing is reinforcing blame by asking questions starting with why. For example, why don't you leave? Why do you stay? Why do you love him? Why do you still love him? Instead, what's really helpful is to say, what makes you stay? What makes it impossible for you to leave? What is it about him that makes him lovable? These three questions at the end are trauma-informed, and from that, our understanding and practice follows.
Norma, you have talked separately about the effects of trauma on the brain and the research that shows that brain development can be impacted by the mother experiencing trauma in the last trimester of her pregnancy. Could this affect the child later in life?
Early research with animals concluded that when the brain missed a developmental stage, the brain would be permanently impaired. But research with humans using functional fMRI scans shows the opposite. So when we hear somebody saying, "I'm not able to change," or "I can't change," that is a belief and not a fact. From a trauma perspective, we hear that as saying that we hear the words "I can't change" as changing is something I cannot do because of the emotional or behavioural consequences and the amount of pain or distress that I would experience by changing. We can also add a few other words onto that. We hear somebody saying, "I don't care." What they're actually saying to us from a trauma perspective is, "Caring is something that is too painful for me to do," or "I don't remember." What we're hearing is, "Remembering is something I cannot do." Not that I'm not willing to do it, I can't do it because pain that is involved and the distress is just too much, and I go out of my window to flight away from that distress. So by us understanding the impact on the brain and the consequences which follow from that, our work and our practice becomes trauma-informed. We stop blaming and shaming clients for their coping strategies and their behaviours used to ensure their survival then and now. Shaming and blaming is done without empathy or compassion. It does not develop trust or the potential for change or recovery. We can understand and explain behaviours. We don't excuse them, but we do that with empathy and compassion. And by doing that, build trust and positive outcomes for our clients and, as a side effect, for ourselves. One of the fears that I hear about working for as long as is needed to work with folks recovering from trauma, we're working with empathy and compassion, is that there's a risk of creating dependency on us as individuals or on our organisation, which would be damaging or unhealthy. Well, we know that because we're now trauma-informed, that being reliable, consistent, empathic, available creates independence, well-being and healthy outcomes. If we think about that in relation to our children, we don't offer our children a crazy, confused, inconsistent, reliable form of attachment, because what would happen? They would never leave home. They would stay with us forever because their needs have not been met. Instead, by offering that consistent, reliable, empathic form of relationship, our children leave home, our clients move on. Success. So why do we fear the same strategies would cause dependency? Well, however, if our organisational responses to need is not trauma-informed and it is disorganised, unreliable and target-led and meeting its own rather than our clients' needs or meeting inspectors' needs, then it will fail.
Norma, we often label people as disengaging from services or frequent flyers. Often they attend for the first meeting and then step away from services until the next crisis, then re-engage with services. Do you think that trauma is a major factor for people who are labelled as disengaging from services?
I have no doubt about that. Absolutely, definitely. When we're assessing or providing services that are not trauma-informed, we ask questions which make people feel blamed and or shamed for their failures as parents or partners or even as human beings. We do that by asking questions which trigger too much pain to answer and to evoke the same coping strategies that were used to ensure their physical or emotional survival. I was talking earlier about the Fs and dissociations. Or the interventions that they're then offered are either the interventions that are only available, but not actually those that are needed. Or When we hear the answers are misinterpreted. For example, the following conversation, which I overheard between a victim and her social worker as part of an assessment that was being done. What impact is the violence having on your children? The answer, it must be terrible because it's so awful for me. I can't sleep or eat for days. I'm so upset. I'm so distressed. I need help. What help do you need? I don't know. Why do you not leave him? I love him. He's not violent all the time. It's my fault when he is. It's not your fault he's violent. You must have been told that when you went on the Living with Violence course. Last time I met with you, you needed to meet your GP. Have you been to the GP to get your prescription for antidepressants and your sleeping pills renewed? Oh, and another thing I heard from the school, the children are often late and hungry. You agreed the last time that you'd ask your mother for help. Have you done that? So many questions, so much blame, so much shame. So of course the response is to disengage and flight from this ridiculous, ill-informed, blaming and shaming line of questioning. What does the woman do? She leaves the room crying. She's not able to stay in her window. She doesn't keep the next appointment because she knows the next appointment will bring more blame and more shame, too much pain, and too much misunderstanding again. What was then recorded by that social worker afterwards was that she was too focused on her own needs and caring more about her own needs than her children's, that she had not followed the advice agreed, accessed the services offered, and had failed the last three appointments. The children are to be monitored in the future by the school. Case closed.
Norma, you've made it absolutely clear why people wouldn't want to go back into that situation. So it's clear from an individual point of view why being trauma-informed is so important. But from an organisational point of view, what are the benefits?
It's quite simple, really. The emotional needs and well-being of our would be enhanced for our clients and for the workers in the short, the medium and the long term. I can give you some statistics of the histories of parents whose children had been taken into care from the PAWS programme charity. And these are really interesting to compare with the statistics from the impact of ACEs or adverse childhood experiences. So first, the statistics from the PAWS programme. 98% of the women attending had been involved in drug and alcohol misuse, 71% domestic abuse, 51% street sex workers, 49% had been in care, 47% had chronic mental health issues, 35% had been involved in criminal proceedings, 14% were learning disabled, and 8% had been diagnosed with a personality disorder. Then we compare those with the outcome of ACEs, where folks who have experienced more than four ACEs, more than four adverse childhood experiences, are four times more likely to be high-risk drinkers, six times more likely to have had or have caused an unintended teenage pregnancy, six times more likely to smoke, 11 times more likely to have used cannabis, 14 times more likely to have been the victim of violence, 15 times more likely to have committed violence against others in the last 12 months, 20 times more likely to have been incarcerated. Those statistics would not happen in the future and would be looked back on with amazement that those things had ever been allowed to happen within an organisation, within a community, within a town, within a country. We add to that the benefits of staff satisfaction, well-being and retention, and the reduction of all of those generational costs of sorting out one generation after another, after another.
Norma, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today as part of the first of our series of podcasts. You have given us some incredibly powerful food for thought and really enlightened insight that will help us now look at some of the cases that we're exploring as part of Adults and Children's Safeguarding Reviews. So just as a final note, do you have any thoughts that you would like to leave us with before you finish?
Yes, of course. You know, I'm sure everyone in helping professions starts off with a strong will to help and meet the challenges offered with hope and compassion. When the focus of agencies is on doing the right thing to meet cost targets and external measures of success, and not on doing the right things with our practice not being trauma informed, then workers are very likely to experience vicarious trauma. Their will, their hope and compassion will be lost. And as it becomes lost, they become less creative, more rigid. They're led by available resources and targets as a measure of their agency's and their own success. Not a happy place to be. But by practice being trauma informed, we find ourselves doing the right thing and we find ourselves doing things right. Satisfaction for everybody.
Thank you, Norma. And thank you to everyone for listening to this podcast from the Safeguarding Oldham Partnership. Thanks.